I'm Matt Green, I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date's January 26, 1987. And if you're new so you don't miss the rest of my talk, that means I'm 23 years sober. Because I used to do that when I was new. I would sit back there at these conferences and he would throw out different dates. And so I tried to figure, okay, if he's this date, this. And so he's got to be probably this many years sober. And now he threw out this date. And now he's got to be this, he's probably this old and shit. So, and then the next thing I know, we're saying the Lord's Prayer and I missed everything in between, you know. And, So I'm 23 years sober, and I'm 57 years old, and so you don't have to figure this out. And I have three children, I have four grandchildren, my youngest son Jerry came with me, and his half brother ended up coming. My son's girlfriend was supposed to come, and she got really sick, and so at the last minute, they called Harlan and asked if Christopher could come. He's heard me and he's been, you know, he's like my son. He's growing up with me. But he's never actually heard me talk at a conference. He was really, really jazzed to get to come to, he's not an alcoholic, but that seems really weird to get jazzed to go to an Alcoholics Anonymous conference. But he was really jazzed to get to come hear me talk. Because he's never got to. And Jerry's got to hear me tons of times. You know, he's been raised with me since he was a tiny baby in diapers. You know, I've been a single parent forever, you know. And I did get married for a little while there in sobriety. And me and Marty were talking before this meeting got going. And, you know, last time we spoke together was years and years ago. And we were both talking. We were both married back then, too. And that's not true today. Those wives are history. When I get going with my story, you'll find out that it's not my fault, my marriage is, because I've been married and divorced 8 times, and that proves it's not my fault. I keep trying, you know. You know that. You know, and my kid was trying to help me out right before I came up here. He did something. You know, he's got one of those phones. You got internet. You got every friggin' thing you can do. And he's looking up something. He goes, "Dad," "look here. I looked up, and you got 51 different." Counts of something I was convicted of and 38 something else. And he goes, "But Dad, you don't have any pending warrants out for you." That's awesome. That was good. That was good news. It's like, why don't you just walk up there and give my talk for me? He goes, "You know, I could do that, you know." And, you know, when we got here and we were in the registration line, you know, one of the guys was pounding the kids, you know, "How long are you guys sober?" And my kids were looking at me like, "What do we say? What do we say?" You know, these two kids, they can have a couple beers and stop, and it's not no problem. It's like, I don't know where they got that from. Because I know their mother, too. And I said that funny-wise, and the sad thing of their mother's dying from this illness called alcoholism. And she caused a lot of harm with those two boys, and she still continues to cause harm in those boys' lives. And they won't talk to her, and they won't answer her phone calls, and it's really sad. And I used to tell her years ago in sobriety, you know, I go, there's going to come a day those boys won't talk to you. And she goes, oh, I'm their mother. They'll always love me, and they'll always talk to me. I'm their mother. And it's sad what this illness of alcoholism does to families. I'm so grateful to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and this loving, caring God that I found here that I don't do that to these boys' lives, and that they call me every day, and they love to go to Seaside, Oregon with me. You know, that they love to be involved in my life, and it's only because of people like you and this God I found here in Alcoholics Anonymous that's possible. You see, left to my own devices, you know, those boys wouldn't have nothing to do with me. You see, my older two kids, for the first years of their lives, they weren't allowed to be around me. I didn't know where they were. You know, I guess I should start about drinking now. I love talking about my kids and my grandchildren and how awesome sobriety is. And I almost forget to talk about drinking sometimes. But I wasted a lot of good years I could have been drinking by not drinking, because drinking works so good when you first start out. And you know, I waited a long time. It was a summer between the third and fourth grade. And, you know, in the doctor's opinion, it says we drink essentially for the effect produced by alcohol. And when you're drinking hot Thunderbird, it's not for the taste, I'll tell you that. And nobody had to teach me how to guzzle. It just came natural right out of the gate. And it didn't make everything all wonderful, but the madness that was going on inside me, the part of unable to deal with reality and life and the madness that was going on inside, it just made that all okay. It didn't matter that I was different and that, you know, I was a scared little kid and I didn't feel like I fit in a family I belonged in. Well, it wasn't really a family. I mean, it was just torn apart by alcoholism. But, you know, I didn't feel like my brothers were my brothers. And, I hated going to school. I hated getting out of bed. I hated every part of life. You know, there wasn't nothing about my childhood I enjoyed. And that summer, you know, getting that hot Thunderbird wine, it was like awesome. It was right before the fourth grade. And it didn't take very long, you know, and I'm in school and I'm scared to death. And just to get through the day till I could get out of school and get that hot Thunderbird wine and guzzle it and make everything okay. It was the only thing I thought of all day at school, was just to get through the madness and the kids picking on me and just the madness of life, knowing it's going to be okay to get to that hot Thunderbird wine and take a drink of it. It wasn't very long, you know, and I thought, you know, why do I wait till after school? I could probably drink before school, and school wouldn't be too bad. And you know, I took a, guzzled a bunch of hot Thunderbird wine before school, and you know what? Those kids that picked on me, I could whip their asses. All of a sudden, I wasn't afraid of them anymore. And I mean, instantly, I became the tough guy of the whole school. It spread like wildfire. Don't mess with this Matt Green kid. He'll whip your butt. And I instantly became the tough guy in this little town, this little hick town I grew up in. That was part of my problem. I needed to be living in a big city, not in this little hick town, you know. And everybody rode horses and, you know, it was just, you know, where they had cowboy boots with one pant leg in, one pant leg out, and it just... You know, I needed excitement going on in my life, you know, and I'm stuck in this little hick town. And you know, when you're in the fourth grade, it's hard to get booze. So, so you got to get into a little bit of stealing. And, you know, and you get into that. Nobody had to teach me how to do it. I was quite well at it. But eventually you're going to get caught, and eventually you're going to end up in juvenile hall. And I was afraid when I first went in there, and you know, fear motivated me so bad I just beat the heck out of the first kid I came across. And it went through juvenile hall, don't mess with this Matt Green kid, he's wild and crazy. And I became the tough guy in juvenile hall. You know, once in a while, my mom would bring one of her drunken boyfriends home, and she would show up at home every month or so, and those drunken boyfriends would beat the crap out of me, and I'd wake up in a pool of my own blood, and, you know, I hated it, man. I wanted out of there. It's like, don't trust nobody, don't get close to anybody. You know, you just drink to forget this madness of this world you're living in. And I got hooked up with some Hell's Angels at 10 years old, and I thought, this is the answer, man. These guys do whatever they want to do. They go wherever they want to go. Nobody screws with them. This is the answer. This is the answer to life, man. And they accepted me as this 10-year-old kid, and I did whatever they wanted to do, and life is great, man. And the night before I turned 13 years old, I got one more beating, and I'm done. I'm out of here. And I moved in with the president of the Fresno chapter of the Hell's Angels, and I know we're not supposed to talk about that other stuff, but, you know, it's funny how we're not supposed to talk about that, and Big Book talks about morphine and sedatives and mixing that shit, but, you know, they held out a handful of stuff, and, you know, I was drunk enough, and they said, take this. I want to belong so desperately. I want to be part of this deal so... I mean, there's nothing in the world I want to belong to more than... And I can't say, was it due or how much do you take? I can't look weak in front of my peers, man, and I just take it. And, you know, it's not my first blackout, but when I come to in the morning, it's like, man, I took that stuff that you're not supposed to take. And, you know, in the early 60s, this is, you know, that stuff was a no-no, and you're worthless if you take it, but I couldn't get out of bed to go to work, and they said, take this white powder stuff, you'll make it to work, and, you know, so you don't ask how much or what will it do, you just take it, and, you know, I don't know what kind of alcoholic you are, but I always overshoot the mark. You know, at that time in my life, I'm pulling out transmissions out of the cars or rebuild them, and I put them back, and my boss, he drinks and gets loaded, and you know, I'm under this car supposedly pulling this transmission now, and he kicks a creeper. He goes, man, you must have took too much of that white stuff. You're not getting any work done. You're just spinning round and round on the creeper. And he goes, you better drink something and slow down. And next thing I know, he goes, man, you must have drank too much. All you're doing is sleeping. And you know, that started this madness of trying to take the right combination of anything to function in the world. You know, I just kept getting in, you know, my 16th birthday, I justified it, I don't stick a needle in my arm. And, you know, my 16th birthday, that happened. And man, it worked so good with that other stuff, I stuck some tequila gold in my arm. And man, you know, if you're really, really broke, man, you know, stick some tequila gold in your arm and you're like snot slinging drunk like right now, you know. The inside of your body feels like it's on fire, but, you know, you got to be willing to go to any lengths, you know. And, you know what happened for me is I just kept running out of institutions, and you know it's like I didn't mind going to institutions because running the Hell's Angels and I got my colors and all that, and it's like part of the deal. The more you get locked up, the more notoriety you have. You know, I mean, people respect you and you're somebody, and you know, I ended up going to CYA, but you know the problem with that kind of stuff. You know, when you're a Hell's Angel, it is not cool going to juvenile hall. I mean, it's cool to go to jail or prison, but not CYA, you know. And so my dream is I want to turn 18 and go to jail. you know, and my dream comes true. I turn 18, and I'm 18 by by about a week, and we've been robbing this Taco Bell. We had it set up with the manager of this Taco Bell, and he let us know when to come by and rob him, and when the most money would be there, and that idiot thought we split it in thirds, but he never got his third. But we met these two blondes that morning, and we're drinking Tequila Gold again, and I think it was Carla talking about Tequila Gold. Tequila Gold always was a... I didn't think it was a problem, but looking back, it really was. But we picked up these two blondes that morning, and blondes always get me in trouble too, you know. And blondes have been a major problem most of my life. And you know, there was a couple brunette wives in there, but most of them were blondes, and they want us to eat some of that orange sunshine acid with them. And no, we got some work we got to do tonight. We got to be alert, you know. Tequila Gold's cool, but acid's out, you know. And somewhere that afternoon, they talked us into eating it finally. And you know, what happened was Taco Bell closed, and we didn't get over there and rob him. And we got a big deal going down the next day, so those girls screwed us over. And we got rid of those girls, and we found this rich restaurant, you know, back in Fresno back then. And we had a plan. You know how Plan A always sounds real good to us, right? Plan B is never worth a shit, but Plan A is always real good. And so I'm going to get the bar cash register, and Mark's going to get the restaurant cash register, and we get in there, and man, when you're loaded on acid, diamonds look really, they just sparkle, and... So we decide to rob everybody in the restaurant, too, we were in there way too long, a cop walked in the back door and said, "Freeze," and if I hadn't taken the acid, it would have been... Anyways, it freaked me out, and I shot that cop. And luckily, he was way across the restaurant and just knocked him down and didn't seriously damage him or anything. But, I'm sitting in jail. And we get to AA and we don't want to do inventories. But when I'm locked up, I'm always doing inventories, you know. It's never about the booze. But it's like, man, and I don't believe in God. I'm not one of those guys that get to jail and does this, "Hey, God, if you get me out of this, I'll never do this again." I thought that was for those weak guys in jail. I never believed in God. I didn't believe in doing that kind of crap. It's like, man up and do your own time and be a man about it. And I never did that kind of stuff. But it's like, if I could ever get out of this mess, what could I do differently? And I did get off those charges. The cops screwed up, and I beat those charges, and I got out. And it's like, I want to die on my 21st birthday. I want to be robbing a bank and national news to be there. And I want to come out and have a shootout with the cops. I want to get on my Harley, and I want to get pumped with about 50 bullets on national news. And me and the Harley go end over end, and it bursts in flames. And, it's going to be glorious. And it's going to be on national news. And I'll shoot a couple of cops along the way on my 21st birthday, but I'm just barely 18 years old, and... So I need to slow this down, because, I'm going to start going to jail like minor robbery or assault and battery and work up to shooting cops on my 21st birthday. And so I think, well, maybe I'll get married. That's what I'll do. But the problem with getting married is you're supposed to let someone in close enough and act like you care and stuff. And the problem with that is I think if someone gets that close to me, you'll find out that I'm really full of fear and I'm afraid and I'm just this frightened little child inside, and I can't let that happen. But, I'll go ahead and get married. And so I checked with all seven girls I was engaged to, because...
Coffee or whatever?
Yeah, coffee. you. Yeah. You know, because, you know, I'm the type that more of everything is better, just not booze, you know. But, you know, back then, you know, this was in 1970, you know, if you got a girl pregnant, you married her. So out of those seven girls, one of them said she was pregnant, so I married her. And we had this Hell's Angel wedding up in Reno, you know, she said the I do stuff, and I said, till death do we part, or something like that. And we got her really drunk, and she passed out, and we put her in the room, and me and my Hell's Angel buddies, we went out for 3 days and tore up Reno, and we just had a really good time. I don't remember what we did, but we had a good time, and went and picked her back up 3 days later, and she was pissed, man, but, you know, it's like, these are the rules, man. You know, that's just the way it is. You know, you stay home and we go do whatever we do. That's just the way it is in the Hell's Angels, and you accept it or tough, you know. And I didn't really want to be that way, but that's just the way the game was played back then. And, you know, I hated doing that to her, really, but that's just the way the rules were. And you got to look tough and act tough, and you can't let your defenses down, because if you do, someone's going to take advantage of you. And that girl really pissed me off, because that kid didn't come out for 18 months, man. And that child's 37 years old today, and he can't stop using, and his mother's the biggest enabler, and that kid does not have any sense of responsibility, that kid, he says the only peace he has in his life is when he's over my house and I'm talking to my sponsees. He says it's the only time he's safe, but he won't do anything. His mother keeps bailing him out. You know, she's married to a dentist today, and makes enough money to enable the hell out of those kids. So he's 37 years old and doesn't know how to do anything except for use. Anyways, we weren't together 18 months later. You know, I mean, that's how I do marriages. You know, you split up right away and you just get back together for a weekend or a week every so often. And women were taking advantage of me then. You know, I'd get drunk and I'd come to, and they'd show me a wedding certificate, you know, you hadn't got a divorce from the last one yet, so you just rent another house and set up like housekeeping with another one, and you know, like, you know, now I come to, and here's this fourth wife showing me a wedding certificate. I'm not divorced from any of them yet, and it's like, dang, man, I'm building a shopping center in Modesto. I have this contractor's license, and I hadn't been to the job site in a while, and so I need to get over there. I don't have time to rent another house. So it's like, what am I going to do with this fourth wife? It's like, I'll just take her home to the third wife. I don't have time for this. So I took her home to the third wife, and they weren't getting along real well and stuff, you know. And, you know, so I left and I said, I'd be back in a month. You guys decide who's going to stay and who's going to go. When I got back, the fourth one was there, the third one left. And I didn't like the fourth one, so I paid my guys to tie her up and haul her off and go by and pick my girlfriend up and move her in. And, you know, it's just, my life was unmanageable as hell. You know, for the crimes I'm committing, I'm just going in and out of insane asylums. You know, that for the violent crimes back then, they would lock you up in these nut wards and evaluate you. And when you were really, really crazy and did violent crimes like shooting cops and stuff, they would just thorazine you out so bad, I don't know what the hell they were evaluating. Like, there's this, they built this huge mental institution called Atascadero in California, And when they first opened it up, it was for the violent, criminally insane. And I made it over there when they first opened it up for some charges I got picked up on. And we could smoke in the institutions back then. We weren't allowed to have matches, but... So, you know, I'll tell you what a day like was in there. It's like you made it from your bed to the day room, and you'd get a cigarette out, and you'd work on trying to get that baby to your mouth, you know? And somewhere through the day, you'd get it to your lips. And then in the back of the day room there in the concrete wall was this, it looked like a cigarette lighter in your car. Yeah, it was glowing red all the time. It was indentured in the wall. And you just go up there and aim for that hole, you know. And when you thought you were lined up, you just fell forward, you know. And if you miss the hole, you smash the cigarette and you had to start all over again. It's funny. It wasn't funny back then, man. And then you just go sit back down at the day table, and you couldn't smoke. You couldn't hold your hand up like that. You just sit there and watch it. Like that. And the ashes would fall down, and when it got to the cherry, to the filter, it just fell down, and you just got and went to... It took all friggin' day just to do that. And they would bring you a little something to try to eat once in a while. And I did 4.5 months in that institution, and when I left there... They evaluated me as unconstitutionally incapable of adapting to a society way of life and homicidal. I don't know what the hell, how that observation they got that diagnosis from. That's all I did every day, one cigarette a day, you know. You know, at 23 years old, the courts decided I need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous and... They made me a deal 2 years back in the penitentiary or 5 days a week for a year, and I couldn't make up my mind. So he gave me 5 days in jail to make up my mind. And when I came back to court, it was the day I made up my mind, and I said, I tried it AA. I hadn't done that before, so I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and that first day I showed up early. I don't know why, and these two old farts, you know. I mean, everybody was like really, really old. I couldn't go in the same town I was in, you know. God forbid somebody see a Hell's Angel going into AA meeting, you know. And these two old guys took me through the doctor's opinion, and you know what? I understood what that doctor's opinion was saying. I understood if I took a drink, I didn't know when I was going to stop. And I knew my life was unmanageable. I knew I had this obsession in my mind that was unbelievable and uncontrollable. I knew all that. I knew I was in full flight from reality. I knew I couldn't differentiate the true from the false. I knew all that stuff to be true. But you know what? I wanted to die desperately at 23 years old. You know, so all this was, you know, I told those guys that day, this stuff is useless information. I go, if I can die today, that would be way better. You know, by this time, you know, I'm pulling guns on cops and not pulling the trigger so they would shoot me. And I'm coming to out of surgery still alive and pissed off. It's like, why? What do I got to do to die? And I just went through a lot more years of hell going in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and the day I know, I just kept going back to Alcoholics Anonymous because it was the only hope I had going for me in my life, even though I wanted to desperately die. You know, at 30 years old, I got married again, you know, and that was to Jerry's mother. And, you know, there have been a lot of suicide attempts, you know. If you can see my left arm, it's scarred really bad. They said if you cut your wrist both ways, you know, and that'll work. And if you see my left arm, it's really mangled to death. And, so, you know, today I believe God always puts some person or something in the way to where, you know, I was close as you could be to dying, but I always made it, you know, because I was desperately trying to die. And, you know, I got married and got the ranch again and, you know, had another kid, which was Jerry. And, you know, things just really sucked in my life. And I'm just, you know, I desperately want to die. But, you know, on the outside, everything always looked good in my life. You know, I always made a ton of money and I could screw it all off in a matter of a couple months. I could have the new Harleys, the new Lincolns, and the ranch and everything, and the horses and all that again. And you know, but inside I desperately want to die. And you know, when I kick her out and she won't come back, and Jerry's like 11 months old, and she calls me up and says, you know what, I'm taking off. You'll never see your kid ever again. And something just snapped. You know what, another wife isn't going to do this to me. And I grabbed a shotgun. I stopped at 7-Eleven and bought two bottles of champagne to celebrate. I'm going to blow her head off. I'm going to take this little baby. I'm going to run. And I went over there, and she wasn't home. And I kicked the door, and it didn't matter. Her neighbors were there, and they knew I was locked up a lot. And I was insane. And, it, you know, it just don't matter, man. I'm going to do this, and I'm going to take this kid, and I'm going to run. I don't know what I'm going to do after that, but I'm going to run. And the SWAT team shows up, and you know, I don't know why at this time in my life I can't shoot another cop. And you know, I get to thinking, you know what, society deserves what I've done to it. Society made me the animal I am. You know, my kids would be better off without me in this world, though. And I stuck that shotgun in my head, and I pulled the trigger. And when I came to out of that coma in the hospital months and months and months later, that's where I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous again. I think it was Carla talking about each and I too also. And that's where the people from Alcoholics Anonymous would, I mean, I'm strapped to this hospital bed. Every part of my body that would move is strapped with leather restraints. I have this plate that snaps up inside my head. If I popped it out right now, I can't talk still, but I didn't have this plate in there. I'm almost all the way blind. This is just a big blur out here. I was 100% blind then, though. I had life support systems hooked up to me. The doctors came in and said, boy, there's nothing we can do for you. You're going to die on every day. They told me that. And the people from Alcoholics Anonymous would come up, knock on the door. They'd sit down on the chairs in my room, and they'd ask me, can we read you the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? Like I had a choice in the matter, you know? And they took shifts every day, all day long, month after month after month, reading me that friggin' book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, so desperately, I wanted to tell them, man, you know what, I'm an alcoholic, but my case is different. See, I always, all those years of going to Alcoholics Anonymous, my case was a little tiny bit different than yours. And if I'm a little tiny bit different than you, I don't have to do what you do. And you see, desperately, I want to tell me I'm an alcoholic of your variety. But you see, I'm blind and dying. So that separates me from you one more time. But I couldn't talk. I couldn't see who they were to kill them if I ever lived through this. I couldn't. And they brought this friggin' tape deck in there and these stack of tapes. And when they left at night, they'd say, you want to listen to a speaker tape? I couldn't wiggle my head. No, I couldn't say no. So they put a friggin' speaker tape on. You know how the nurses come in like every hour, all night long, and wake you up to check your vitals and all that? So they thought I enjoyed those tapes so much, all night long they put another speaker tape on. So 8.5 months of listening to these friggin' speaker tapes, you know. I mean, I heard so many friggin' speaker tapes. And so when I get out of the hospital, you want to go to AA meeting? Oh, you bet. Because when I shot myself, that made the national news. They made a big deal out of it, this Hell's Angel convict guy. And so now everybody I'd screwed over, everybody I'd shot, everybody I'd done, you know, now they're going to be able to finally get me, you know, because I'm blind and I did live through it. And you know, all the stuff I had, people were... You know, I did have a lot of stuff, and people were finding out, you know, most people did think I died, and they stole everything I had, and you know, so I want to hide out in Alcoholics Anonymous, because they're about to kill me, like, you know, it's funny, I wanted to die, but, you know, I don't want these people to find me and do it. You know, it's got to be my terms, you know. And so I'm going to 3 to 5 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got the sponsor. I'm doing the deal. I'm not doing no service work. But I'm, you know, I got this one little secret. I'm working the steps. I'm going to minimum 3 meetings a day. But there's going to be a day I want to die, you see, because I can't stand living being blind. I'll never be able to live blind for the rest of my life. And my sponsor's on my ass, you only got to do it for a day. Oh, yeah, I'm doing it just for today. I can live being blind today. But in my head, there's going to come a day when I'm going to have to end this madness because I can't do it for the rest of my life being blind. And I'm saving up all my pills from my surgeries, all these synthetic morphine tablets. And so over the next 2 years, I drank 3 times. And the 4th time, I had 455 synthetic morphine tablets. And after a meeting, I guzzled all of those pills down with 2 half gallons of vodka. It's time to check out. And when I came to on January 26, 1987, I was pissed. And after that point, I never, ever, you know, I would say the prayers before the meetings and after meetings. I'd hold hands with you guys, but I'd leave the word God out. But that morning, you know, when I came to, it's like, you know what? If I keep doing this, I'm going to keep missing body. My whole body over the years, the motorcycle wrecks and the getting shot and all the surgeries you know, most of my face was missing. I mean, you could physically stick your hand inside my head. This is how much they put me together in sobriety. But the bone grafts and everything, you know, I'd just been pinned and wired and screwed and plates and so. I mean, every part of me has been worked on somewhere or pinned together. And I mean, there's only one original part left. And I think, you know, if I keep drinking, I'm going to lose that sucker too. And alcoholics are so sick. I have never once said what that part was, and you guys are sure you know what part it is. You know? But I, you know, that morning I got to, you know what, this madness is just going to keep going on, and I'm just going to keep missing body parts till I go in the insane asylum to never leave there ever again. And, you know, I was too weak to stand up, and I just rolled out of that bed. And it was a cussing prayer, and I believe that God understands when it's the best we can do. I really, really believe that. And, you know, I'm not going to say the prayer I said then because I don't pray that way today. But, you know, I rolled on my knees. And basically what I did was I told God, you know what, I give up. I'm done. Whatever you and Alcoholics Anonymous wants me to do, I'm willing to do whatever. I can't do it my way anymore. And I went to the new meeting that day, and I went in early, you know, because I was taught if you're not at a meeting 30 minutes before the meeting, you're late. And I still do that today. I told old timers what had happened, and I'll do whatever they want me to do. And I go, okay, so what do you want me to do? And they call me boy, and you know, I just really hate that boy shit. You know, I'm a Hell's Angel, I'm a convict, I ain't no damn boy, you know. And I tell them, the only reason why you call me boy, because if I could see you, I'd whip your asses, you know. And They told me, boy, we want you to go out and pick up the cigarette butts. I go, man, that ain't happening, man. They go, we thought you said you'd do anything we wanted you to do. And I go, yeah, but you know, this ain't right that we have the circus act. The blind boy goes out and pick up the cigarette butts. We all gather at the window, you know, and watch the blind boy. They said, well, are you going to tell God or do you want us to tell him? And I go, never mind, I'll go pick up the cigarette butts. And that was a little over 23 years ago, and so I still pick up the cigarette butts. I'm not one of those that gets a lot of time around here and thinks, oh, I don't have to do that anymore. I'm one that whatever worked in the beginning years of sobriety that got me to find, to have serenity and peace and to have the spiritual awakening with God in the beginning years, I'm not one that thinks I don't have to do that anymore and leave it for the newcomer. I think I still need to do it today, 23 years later. You know, there was a guy from Washington, my kid teases me the way I say that, down my home group a couple days ago. Well, he was down in Fresno, and he heard me at a conference up there, and he had got my phone number, and he goes, where's your home group and stuff? And I told him, he goes, are you going to go to the meeting today? I go, yeah. And he goes, what time do you get there? And I told him, and he goes, what time does the meeting start? And I told him, and he goes, so will you be out there picking up cigarette butts? And I go, you bet I will be. I see so many people quit doing stuff because their lives get full again. They get their relationships back again, and the work's full again, and the kids are back again, and then all of a sudden they're spun again if they don't drink again. And I don't know, I've just never quit doing anything that I did in the beginning years. I'm still really involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, no matter whether when I got married or, you know, when I got 100% custody of Jerry. I never quit doing what worked in the beginning. But I got real active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't like it all the time. You know, I was 5 days sober, and they told me, boy, we need to go down to the jail and take the meeting down there. I said, no. You said, no. I've been to jail too many times, and they go, we thought you said you'd do anything. I go, I got an easy one out this time. I go, I got warrants for my arrest still. And they go, well, they don't check your IDs or nothing. You just go do the panel. It's like, dang. So I went and did the, I got some guy to take me down there, some other newcomer, and we went down and did the meeting. We both had warrants for arrest, and that's before we required to have clearances and stuff, and we did the meeting. God, I was scared to death that I wasn't going to get out of that meeting, and they said, well, boy, we need you to not be in cover. We need to do it every week, and I said, well, I'll do it for a year. And last February 1st has been 23 years I've been taking meetings to the jail. Now, I'll be honest, ego has something to do with that. Because if I quit going, someone else might say they've done it longer than me, so I don't. And part of that's true, and part of it is I absolutely love going into the jail. I absolutely still get excited walking out that last locked door. It still excites the crap out of me when that last door slams shut behind me. It's my choice. I'm out of there. And I love hearing the goofy stories them guys tell us. You know, I was just there, not this last Thursday because we flew up here, but the Thursday before, and the last guy to share, he goes, yeah, I've been in two programs before. I'm not alcoholic, but I see where this inventory stuff you guys do is really helpful. When I get out of jail, I'm getting involved in another program so I can do inventory work, but I'm not an alcoholic. And after the meeting was over and those guys are walking to their cell, I go, I'm so glad you're not an alcoholic, but, you know, you sure you don't want to really look at this? I mean, the guy's in jail. He's been through two programs, and he really sees it, how helpful the inventory steps are. But he's not alcoholic, and it's just, you really hear some funny stuff in the jails, you know? I got involved in sponsoring guys right away. The first guy that asked me to sponsor him was a gay guy. God, I did not want to do that. Hells Angels don't sponsor gay guys. I told that guy, I have to get back to you. And I called my sponsor, and I told my sponsor this about this guy wanting me to sponsor. He goes, you absolutely should. I go, you don't understand, you know, Hell's Angels, convicts don't sponsor gay guys. And he goes, it's going to be a learning, growing experience. Man. And, you know, I sponsored that guy for 8 years till he died of AIDS. And his family never could accept that he was gay, and so his family wasn't there. And so I was the only one there, and I was able to, you know, through this process, you know, sponsoring that guy, I was able to understand what unconditional love was about through sponsoring this guy. And I was able, you know, and that's back when they didn't know a whole lot about AIDS, and this guy had sores all over him, and I was able to hold that guy while he was dying, and you know, I didn't know what, you know, I didn't know what it was about really, but I knew I had to hold this guy, and I loved him dearly when he was dying. And you know, I thanked that guy when he was dying for being a part of my life and allowing me to love him, you know. And you know, Alcoholics Anonymous has just been, it's taught me how to love, and it's taught me how to care for other people. And you know, our book says we're selfish and self-centered. It's the root of all our problems. You know, my kid Jerry talks to me about it a lot, you know, that his whole life has been brought up in my house. My house is like a recovery place. There's always been people. His life has been brought up with me dragging drunks home, and we find little nooks and corners and get them sober there and throw down a mattress pad on the ground, and we get guys sober there, and we take guys through the steps there, and there's just been a ton of people got sober in my house. And that's the way it's just always been. He's growing up with helping, seeing that we help people, and you know, it's not always been good. And there's people ran up $1,200 overseas sex phone calls on my phone, and you know, one guy robbed a liquor store and came back to the house with the cops following him and ran in. And you know, and luckily the kids were gone. I was gone. I was married then. We were gone doing the conference up in Tahoe. And you know, he went outside and the cops said, drop the gun. He waved at the cops and the cops dropped him in my front yard. And of course, the news cameras were all over it. And you know, here's a sober house with, you know, the names of my businesses all on camera, and they took everybody in the house to jail to sort it out, and this was in sobriety, and everybody's calling, what, did everybody get drunk at the house? What's happening, you know? You know, if you're new here, you know, I mean, it does get better, but you know what, there's going to be some things you got to go. You know, my first year of sobriety, man, I mean, it was, I mean, I was just, you know, I would call my sponsor sometimes 8-9 times a day. I would call 5 other people every day. They say, call 3 people. I thought, you know what, I've been in and out for so many years. If 3 works, I better call 5. And today, I would not call people, just like I would not get up and not brush my teeth. It just becomes a working part of your everyday thing. But my first year, you know, I went home from a noon meeting in the beginning because I went back with their mother. And I was gone to a new meeting, and she changed the locks on the door and moved him in. And so when I got home from the new meeting, she said, you don't live here anymore. And I paid for the rent for that place and stuff. And it's like, I didn't understand that one. I don't live there anymore. But IRS indicted me for $543,000 for income tax evasion. I got my house raided for a narcotics bust. They had the wrong address in the middle of the night. They threw me out in the front yard, no clothes, no nothing. And about an hour into this, they realized they had the wrong address, and I had emergency back surgery. 9 months sober, I got indicted for murder for one I didn't do. And they kept telling me, keep coming back, it gets better. And I can remember saying, you know. If this shit gets any better, I don't know if I could take it, man. You know, by following my sponsor's advice and stuff and asking him for help over and over, I mean, my sponsor knows everything about me. I love that man more than anything in the world. There's not nothing about my life he doesn't know about. You know, because I asked him to help me on those ninth step amends, and I owed $1.2 million when I got sober. And I'll never forget the first check I got from the first job I did. I started contracting again. That was hard to get my contractor's license back because it lapsed when I was in a coma. That was a long, hard process. You know, they don't want to give a contractor's license back to a blind guy with 50-something felony arrest. And, you know, but through the process, you know, my sponsor said, if you want to try to get it back, you know, you see it through till the end. And I got it back, and I started contracting. The first check I got was for, like, after everything was paid, was for $7,000-something. I asked my sponsor to help me. I was afraid. So we went to the store, and I'm thinking I'm going to get this big steak. And he goes, no, you owe that money. You can get a package of hamburger and this macaroni and cheese and top ramen. And I'm thinking, you know, this is a mistake to ask my sponsor for help. But because I followed direction, I got to write that last check at 7 years and 2 months sober, and I was free of all that. And I never thought that I'd ever be free of that. But because I followed direction from my sponsor, I was able to get through all that. And at almost a little over 9 years sober, I had this Al-Anon friend that we were best of friends. We were on conference committees together. Everything was awesome. We had the best time in the world. We thought, why don't we try getting married? We were the best of friends. And outside the wedding chapel, I told my sponsor, I go, you know what? I love her, but I don't think as man and wife it's right. He goes, you don't have to go through it. Well, but on the other hand, you know, we're both involved in a ton of service. I'm this big shot circus speaker. They fly all over. I go, you know what? I can make it work. Out of all 8 marriages, that turned out to be the worst nightmare of them all. And the book says, where have I put myself in the position to be harmed? So it doesn't matter who's to blame in that divorce. I knew better to go through with the marriage, and I did it anyways. So I was the one who set the ball in motion to be harmed. So there's nothing more to be said about that. I was never going to date another girl ever. I wasn't going to sit next to a girl in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I loved my life just the way it was, man. I got my kids. I got my grandkids. I'm flying all over the country. I do all this service work. I sponsor a ton of guys, man. I mean, you know, I take a ton of people through the steps. I mean, my life cannot be any better. I mean, I'm broke because of that last divorce. I'll never see retirement. You know, I'm living like a welfare case, but you know what? My life is absolutely perfect the way it is. I'm never going to date. I'm never going to nothing. And I was up north in Northern California. I was running around at that time really being a smart ass from the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous, saying that I'm accepting resumes for my 9th ex-wife and this little tiny 5 foot tall 98 pound long blonde hair little girl came up to me and said she had a resume for me. And I was going to dinner with some guy's sponsor that moved to the Bay Area with some of his guys from his men's stag at a different restaurant. She was going to dinner with one of her sponsors, had a year at some restaurant, I didn't know where. And so we all left, and we ended up at the same restaurant. We all decided to sit together, and her and me sat together, and what happened... We started talking on the phone long distance every day. She lived in Sunnyvale and I lived in Fresno. And we both fell madly in love with each other. And, you know, I thought I knew what love was like before. Hell, I've been married 7 to 8 times already. But God finally let me know what love was really, really like. And I fell madly in love with this little tiny girl. And it was the most awesome relationship ever, ever in my life. And we started running around the country together, and she started flying around to meet me, and she was real active in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was the most awesome thing. I couldn't believe that's what a relationship was like. And, you know, this 1 week we talked about, you know, her youngest kid was going to be graduating in a little over a year, and that we were needed to start making decisions on what we were going to do for the rest of our lives, because we lived in different towns, and about getting married and all that. And she went to a doctor's appointment 5 days after that. And she had a mole on her back of her neck, and the doctor said it didn't look quite right. And he put her in the hospital, and 5 days later, she died. And that was a year ago, last June 15th. And I was really, really pissed at God. And, you know, I had these commitments to speak over the next 9 days. I had to speak 7 times. And I wanted to cut and run. And I couldn't believe that some old-timers with over 30 years said, Matt, it would be all right, because of Lori dying, that you cancel on your commitments. And I thought, you know what, this isn't right. I got to keep my commitments. I think that's what Lori would want me to do. And I'm so grateful today that I kept my commitments. And I didn't cut and run. And I wanted to really bad. You know, I ended up getting to go up to Sonora the third day after she died to speak up there. You know how it's an old gold town, and you know how those old towns, they have like those old churches, and they have the stained glass windows, and they have candles you can light for somebody and stuff. And I went in there, and there was an old lady in there, and I told her what had happened and why I was there, and she asked if she could pray for me and Lori. And I said yes, and we did that. And she wanted me to light a candle, and I was just shaking too bad from that experience. It was so awesome. I asked her if she would light that candle, and she said yes. And that was the day of her funeral. I don't know how they arrange a funeral that fast. And I couldn't be there because I was speaking that day. And so as she lit that candle, you know, I told Lori, this is my goodbye for you since I can't be there. And, you know, just the whole experience was so awesome. And you know, through writing, you know, I write almost every day. I was able to thank God for the 4 years we had together, and for the privilege of getting to experience that kind of love. And you know what? It's like, okay, now what, God? Now what do you have in store for me? And so for the last, ever since a year ago, last June 15th, it just seems like I sponsor so many guys, and it just seems like I've been bartered with so many more. I've gotten these young guys. I just got a new guy, 19 years old. I mean, I got a grandchild almost that old, and it's like I've just gotten, I thought I couldn't get any busier in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's like I've gotten busier. You know, I haven't made a house payment because of the economy in 27 months. And it's like, God, am I supposed to lose my house? And you know, I had to file bankruptcy last year. And it's like, am I supposed to lose my house now? And go live in a cardboard box behind the Lotto Club and get more of these friggin' newcomers? Or what's going on, God? And my bank just sent me a deal saying, hey, you know what, you qualify for this. Because I applied for a loan modification a year and a half ago or whatever it was. And, of course, I didn't qualify. And, you know, the kind of work I do is in the crapper. And the bank sent me this deal. I called them, they sent me this deal, and it looks like I qualify for this loan modification, and I'm going to be able to afford the payments. And I signed the loan documents last week, and so it looks like I'm going to, but the thing I'm trying to say, like, if you're new, like okay, I didn't stress out over Lori dying, and I'm losing the house, and having to, what I've done is our fifth tradition is our primary purpose. So through all this, I've kept my primary purpose, my primary purpose. I mean, I go to meetings, I work with newcomers, I keep my commitments to the jails, I keep my commitments to the H&I committee, I keep my commitments when people call and say, hey, can I come over? When they call and say, hey, can you show up at this convention, even though it's cold as hell, you know, will you show up? And, I show up, you know. So no matter what's going on in my life, good and bad, when your girlfriend dies and it's the love of your life, the message is you keep your primary purpose and God will work all that other stuff out. I've kept my primary purpose that I was going to lose my house or get a loan modification. I kept my primary purpose and God worked the rest of it out. So if you're new, I hope you... If you're new, I just hope you grab on to wherever you live at, grab on to somebody that's walked this path and get in that book and learn what we do to get through life. Man, life's going to happen. Now, do you want to get spun and drink over it, or do you want to have a primary purpose and let God control all that stuff? God's going to make it happen whether you're drunk or sober. You know, it's like, why not try to help another new guy get sober and let God work all the other stuff out? Harlan, thanks for having me in. I love you guys. God bless you.